Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello. Just to let you know, this is a two-part episode of Rule of Three. We talked to Eddie Izzard for quite a long time about comedy, his attitude to how jokes work and making stuff up, and we thought we wouldn't cut too much of it. So, yes, listen to this in two parts. This is Eddie on how he works, how he likes to get inspiration, and obviously, as you'd expect, lots of other stuff, and also his love for Third Rock from the Sun, and in particular John Lithgow as a comic performer, and how that's informed his attitude to comedy and acting. So I hope you enjoy it, but it's in two bits, so listen to this bit first, and then there'll be another bit to download later. Enjoy.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is Eddie Izzard.
Hello.
Hello. Eddie. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. We'll not put any specific time. Well, it's sort of afternoon.
Hello.
But you could be listening to it at any time.
In a different time zone.
In different time zones.
We know for a fact from some of our data that we have one listener in Peru.
Very good.
It's a bear. No, yeah. It's right, hello is apparently was developed for people on the telephone, wasn't it? Basically, so because you didn't, the word "hello" because it was a hunting cry. But they developed it because you never knew on the telephone whether someone at the other end was in morning, evening, or night. So you didn't say good morning; you'd say hello, which is what you used to shout across a hunting thing. It's been borrowed.
Apparently. Hang on, so okay, I can understand the phone. Yeah. What's the hunt? What's the hunting? Well, hello, hello, you're
a
bear.
Hello was like a hunting cry. Like, hi, hello, hello there. Whatever.
I don't know. To other people or just get because I know that in a sort of old because old hunting was designed to keep you match fit. From the murder games, as they used to call them before Hunger Games, the murder game, you know, because if, you know, kings were going into battle and all that kind of stuff, that's why they did hunting. So you could use control of horse in difficult situations, and there's dogs, and there's a boar, and then there's going to be a feast afterwards. So it ended up with the boar not having a great time, but that's what hunting was about.
And if we went to war with the boars, we were really, really ready.
Yes, they were not going to rule anyone. King Boar actually managed to gore the king, so he's now the king. No, but so that's what they were doing initially, and it's turned into this more foppish thing of let's just attack a fox and kill him. All the way up to Waterloo, the horse was a key part of battle strategy. I know a lot about military history, as I was going to be in the forces.
Oh, yes, of course.
But when you get to the American Civil War, it's very interesting because at the beginning of any war, you start from the end of what's happening in the last war. So they all went in, they used a lot of horses in the American Civil War, but by the end of it, it was siege tactics. It was trench warfare.
Right.
The siege of Richmond and Petersburg. when Robert E. Lee was being pressed by General Grant. No one could get over their defences. It's just like in World War I, and it's trench warfare, the machine guns. They had the Gatling gun. All that stuff had come in, repeating guns, and so it had all shifted.
Do you find knowing all this stuff is useful? I'm thinking about
career-wise.
With stand-up and things.
It's career.
Because you always said that you were inspired by Monty Python.
Yeah.
You could fuse silliness with total, rigid, well-researched interest in the world.
Well, I can use any military history I know, which I am interested in. I use military sort of tactics to get my career to this point. That's it. Well, that is, or strategy rather than tactics. If your tactics are be positive about being transgender, don't talk about it that much on stage. These are my tactics. My strategy was get it out, get in the open. My career was taking off. I'd come out in 85. But I hadn't told my dad. There was this one stumbling block with my dad. I was advised not to tell dad. It could break him. And I thought, no, dad's tough enough. So 6 years later, having told all my friends, stand-up career in boy mode was taking off. So we're going from 85 coming out. And so this is 91. And I told him on a Saturday at a Crystal Palace football game. And then I talked about it on a Monday. So why am I...
But that was planned with military.
Working out the logic. And... being open was better. That was a better strategy. Right. And then the tactics, I always get tactics and strategy. But strategy is the overall, is the macro of it. And the tactics is what you do if you attack. You know, in military, it would be attacking with guns or mortars or this or that. If I can use intelligence, if I can muck about and be silly with being transgender, my first ever joke. This was my first ever joke. I'll relay it to you. And I thought this will put me in a good place, and it explains things. But no one actually believed me at the end of it. So I said this joke on a Monday night at the New Material Night at the Market Tavern? Yes, the Market Tavern. So upstairs there, and I'd worked out this could work, but I was in boy mode when I said it. So they just thought it was just a funny joke, and then I moved on. But it was basically, I said, if you're going to do stand-up, you've got to talk about something. And so if you're a minority, it can actually help here. Because if you are, say, an ethnic minority, you can say, oh, white people, they have it so easy. You know, God, you can rail against that. Or if you're a woman, you can say, it's men always running the things, and we're just trying to fight for equality. And what was the other? Oh, if you're a low-income background, you say, rich people. So if you're a white male... Mike Mel stand-up, that is just useless. So, thank God I'm a transvestite. So that was my first joke.
Wow.
Which I'd had for about 4 years in my head. One joke and a plan to... I'd told everyone, but I hadn't introduced it into the stand-up. And I knew if the stand-up was going to take off, I was going to move into this lie position where I was just not... It wouldn't be a lie, overt lie, but you just wouldn't be mentioning it. But you think, my career is so important, I'm not... I can't say this now. I just thought it is. I've got to do this because I wanted to be in Special Forces, and it sounds crazy, but I know all about SAS, David Sterling, Paddy Mayne, who took it over when David Sterling was captured. And so instead, if I was not going to do that Special Forces, I was going to do what I've said is civilian Special Forces. This was coming out. If people are going to scream at me in the streets, or if my career was going to go, whatever it was, I'm going to battle that. And I'm the right person to do that. And other people have done great work down the years. And thank God for Stonewall or thank the stars, because I don't believe in God. Thank the stars for Stonewall and any activist before I came along. But I just thought, if people are going to scream at me in the streets and abuse me, then I'm going to give them back as good as they give me. And if they try and fight me, I will fight them back. I'm not a great fighter, but I never trained in that. But that was my plan. So that was the overall strategy, was get it out in the open, no matter where the chips may fall. And then I did that one joke and everyone thought funny, but not real. Then I had to do a gig in a dress, and that was even more key. And that was in the old Meccano Club. And I knew when I said the first joke, I said that joke. So I thought, okay, and I'm in a dress. And he's wearing a dress. Because there hadn't been no announcement. Mm. Why would there be?
Was there a different laugh?
I couldn't monitor that with my equipment. So
no data.
That just worked. And then I thought, now I'm going to talk about Daleks and how in the old days they couldn't go upstairs before the new version. And so I had a lot of things on Daleks. And I thought, if they can accept Daleks from me in a dress, then my career is there. Because I was just taken off. This is my third medium of comedy as well. So I'd use analysis on that. In fact, I use analysis. The analysis came, which is really strategy comes from analysis. You analyze and then you your strategy out. But that came from self-analysis of my own sexuality when I couldn't get an appointment with a psychiatrist at university. So I thought, bugger this, I'll just do it myself. And I just lay on my bed with these curtains closed. And I went through my brain saying, okay, brain, tell me why do you feel these feelings? What is going on in my head? And I tried to do this self-analysis. And I didn't come to big conclusions to set that guilt and shame was not my responsibility. Other people could have that responsibility. I'm a member of society. That was my job, to try and knit with my natural boringness. I have a great natural boringness. I think probably most of us do have, and we cover our boringness with layers of interestingness. And which is, you know, our ability, any comedian's ability to talk is covers over your natural boringness. And so my boringness is a great weapon, because when I meet people, I don't say, come on, let's set fire out of the building, let's do this and that, and Jane, I just say, hi, cup of tea? Yes, cup of tea would be fine, thank you very much. And my natural boringness really helps.
Is that what we all have in common, is an inner boringness?
Probably.
Is the hope for mankind is that we're all quite boring?
It's kind of live and let live, treat other people like to be treated yourself. Most people are in that thing, you know, and people who get into, you know, extreme people in extreme politics, they are such a minority. And the vast majority of the world, you know, 7.5 billion people, it's going to be 7.4 billion plus, you know, many millions as well, are going to be generally live and let live, you know, fairly tolerant, fairly this, you know. Otherwise, they know it's just not very practical. Whereas some people are saying, no, we've got to be very extreme in these ways.
Who's got the energy?
Yes, who's got the energy? Anyway, so if that has answered the question. So, yeah, I talked about dialects and then it took off. So I knew that that was my strategy. So it was having this military mind that I was fascinated by these things that happened in battles. But I thought I can apply that to life, to career, getting America. How do you get America? You know, because everyone said, well, you can't, because no one in America likes British humor. Monty Python? Oh, yeah, but that, what? You know, and Python hadn't designed it to work. John Cleese says they were all pretty sure it wouldn't work in America. Yeah. But then PBS in Dallas put it on and it took off. And I thought, well, if they can do it, then surely another person could do it. And I love their stuff, so my stuff's influenced by theirs.
Yeah.
And I worked out that all I had to – I analyzed it all. I worked out that New York was the place to get. If you do a TV career thing – this is an answer to a long question, isn't it?
That's good. Stuff.
No, it's great.
But if you go in and you try and do a TV series, if you've got your own hit TV series, it can flip over, which, you know, Absolutely Fabulous, Monty Python did, that's fine.
Yeah.
But if you're going there to go and get it, I did the U2 approach, basically. And I looked at touring, but New York first, because they are the tastemaker, not only of America, but also of North America, including Canada. And that was interesting. And I worked at New York, just play New York until New York gives in, and then I could move out from there. That was my...
That's totally military, isn't it?
Yeah,
you found a weak point, like a thermal exhaust port you can fire in. And
yes, it was. I wouldn't call it a weak point. It was the entry gate, because no one's actively trying to stop you.
As an undefended gate, almost.
Yes, it's also the tastemaker. It is the tastemaker. And if you did LA, came in LA, that wouldn't work. If you did a film, and some people did go in and do films, they got a good role, starring role, and if it didn't work, boom, that's the end of that, because they're not going to get a second film. Whereas I could go in and fail in an 80-seater, PS-122 in 96, then PS-122 in 97. I played it for a month in the 80-seater, then I did, I think, 3 weeks in a 120-seater, and then in 88 I came back and did 4 months in a 300-seater, and that was Dressed to Kill. Then I took that to the West Coast, and it was all. But after the first gig, I knew it would work, because there was this weird thing that Americans will not understand the words you say, and I thought, I don't think that's going to be true. But the references will break down. That's the thing. Curly Whirly will not translate unless you tell them what Curly Whirly is. So once you've explained Curly Whirly, this is the thing I said. even in French, you say un Curly Whirly, c'est un bonbon. They call it bonbon. It's a sweet. C'est un bonbon de nougat, de chocolat, and it's a bâton. It's a common baguette. Baguette means stick. Because I always thought when I had a baguette was the name of the bread, but in fact, baguette just means stick.
Yeah,
that's why you can ask for a French stick.
I ran into this in a Japanese restaurant in Paris a few weeks ago.
Right.
My son was struggling with chopsticks, and I wanted to say to the server, my son is struggling with the chopsticks, could we have a fork and spoon, please? And I couldn't bring chopsticks to mind. But I looked it up quickly, and it was baguette.
Because
it's just sticks, isn't it?
Yeah. You eat your Chinese food with two baguettes.
Yeah,
it's nice.
Yeah.
And you play your drums with chopsticks.
Yes, with baguettes.
And a beautiful image.
Yes. So yeah, once you've explained a curly whirly, you can throw it into a French show. Je l'ai frappé avec un curly whirly, or un baguette. Yeah, I hit him with a curly whirly. Or
there's constantly a question of that whenever you're working in collaboration with other people, and the thing you're often told as a writer or a comedian is they won't get that. And it's really good to say, well, if we help them get it, they can get it.
They can get anything. And it's also interesting if you consider that, going back to Python, I know I'm going all over the comedy map here, but go back to the Goons, who influenced Python so much, that John Cleese used to listen to the radio on the Thursday repeats with the radio up against one ear and a cushion on the other ear to hear one joke that he missed, which is stuff that I've done.
So it couldn't escape through the other ear.
Yeah, well,
hold it in.
Just because you want to hear, what is that? Why is everyone laughing so much? I remember tracking John Cleese's early career, which I'm very fascinated with, all the Python's early points before they get to Python. And when people saying, very good, John, of, you know, now at last the 1948 show, I think they started to push the boat there, but even before that, say the Frost Report.
Yeah.
Very funny, lads, but it won't work in Woking.
Yeah.
This kind of thing. But they'd already knew that it would work in Woking from the Goons, interestingly. But they sort of unlearnt the learning process and gone back, no, mainstream's much better because Goons is more of a cult thing and Python is more of a cult thing. So not everyone gets this alternative stuff.
But is it to do with people, not to do with necessarily the references, but how much work an audience is willing to do? So a certain type of audience is willing to meet you halfway and maybe a more mainstream audience will go, I don't get what you're saying, and then we'll pull back.
There's a bit of that, but when I did a TV show, a very mainstream TV show, and you know I was supposed to be someone who people had heard of, but it was quite a mainstream audience. And I was talking about Caesar, did he ever think he would end up as a salad, this piece I had. And then the chicken Caesar salad is now more famous than chicken Caesar, more famous than Caesar salad, because Caesar was advised by chickens in a lot of his battles, particularly the Battle of Alesia. And then I get into Caesar and chicken. So I should build a wall around Alesia. And so Vercing Getrix will come. So I had this chicken talk. And the mainstream audience did not get where I was going. And I think they thought, I was talking about Mark Antony, and maybe they thought, maybe it's just information in, because you have to, for alternative art, cinema, comedy, music, you have to know the basics to be able to move up to the alternative.
Yeah.
So if you take music, everyone knows, okay, three-part progression, certain melodic things. Now, the alternative musician is going to be screwing with that, mucking about with it all over the place and working against those norms so that they don't go into that, because we've all heard that and it's just playing it over and over again. And that's what we do in comedy. I like doing this one. I keep throwing it into the show. My wife's gone to Jamaica. Is it? No, my wife's gone to the West Indies. Yeah, wife's gone. I'm trying to play with that thing. So my wife's gone to the West Indies. Jamaica? No, St. Bart's. That's one of them. My wife's gone to Jamaica. Did you force her? Yes, at first, but then she was... You know, just go into that joke and then keep doing different versions of it. My wife's gone to the West Indies. Yes? Yes. Yes, she did. Oh, well, good.
You sometimes hear that sort of playfulness in kids where they learn the shape of a, what, the chicken cross the road or a knock-knock, and then they retell it in their own rhythm, and it doesn't follow the rules, but there's something equally delightful in it.
Yeah.
It's almost like playing with it like a child.
That is, yes, the child playing, that I definitely think is, particularly in comedy, the child with the adult brain. I like doing another joke where I go, an Englishman, Irishman, Scotsman went into a pub with a Welshman, a Chineseman, a Burgundian crossbowman, two kippers, a fridge, a monkey from outer space, Tutankhamun, three Tutankhamun, and the Pope. And the barman says, right, who's first? And the Pope says, I'll have half a shandy. And then the fridge says... why are you serving him first? He was last on the whole list. I think he came in slightly early because I've got a machine here, said the bum. And I'm not going to do the joke. I'm just going to go this long, long... There is no joke there. And it just goes on. And then the rabbit said, where were... Lads, I'm outside. What am I, keeping KV out here? He said, yeah, you're keeping KV in case the normal police come along, the mainstream audience police come along. Oh, right, I get it. Yeah, okay, I'll put my ears in a bun later as a sandwich. So you're just talking rubbish. This is what I've trained myself to do, is talk rubbish. Any good gig for me is when I make up stuff and I make myself laugh, and then I just sometimes say to the audience,
That's presumably part of your principle, is it? You do actually want to make yourself laugh.
Yeah, well, that's
the same time.
That's, Yes, because I've seen all my gigs and I know what I'm doing. I'm the only one that's seen every minute of every gig. And I know when I'm doing good stuff and when I'm doing medium stuff. And if I can kick myself into another plane where I'm in the zone, or any of us could get into the zone, then you're no longer caring about anything except you're playing and you're floating and you're on this, you're surfing a wave of nonsense. And I've done it in French and German. I'll tell you the German one. So I was mucking about in German, and this group, I said, I talk about Henry VIII in the show, and I said, Henry VIII, he ate everything. I had alles gegessen. Essen is to eat. So I had alles gegessen, that's past tense. So I had alles gegessen, he ate everything. He had all die Schweine gegessen. So Schwein is Schwein, pig. He ate pigs. So I do pigs. Like he's in there in a blender. Oh, and all die Kuh. Kuh is a cow, very close again, Anglo-Saxon. All the cow. And I had all die Schafe gegessen. Schafe is a sheep. Very close again. Schaf against außer ein Schaf, except for one Schaf. And he was ein bisschen anders, a little bit different. He's a schwarzer Schaf, is the black sheep. And he was sehr cool. And er trägt Sonnenbrille, he wore dark glasses. And er hat zwei Jahre in Detektivschule gemacht. Did 2 years in detective school. And Isaac Hayes wrote a song about him that goes, who's the cool detective? Schaff. John Schaff. Now, I did this. It's a John Schaff joke with a T, but I'm just doing it as Schaff. And I did this to the Berlin audiences, and I could see them. They have to wait 30 seconds to see what on earth are you talking about? Where are you going with this? This is just stuff. And then, especially when it gets into dark glasses and the 2 years in detective school. And I could see not all of them getting it, but some of them getting it. He's playing around with a Schaft joke. So what does that prove? Oh, that's playing like a child. And that joke, I kept forcing that joke on them, even though it takes such a long time to set up. But I love doing that, because then that's the advanced level of, you know, so I'm in my third language and I'm improvising. I'm playing around with the word Schaft because it sounds like Schaft. And in English, that T is quite silent. It's beautiful. I mean, in German, I'm asked mein dritte Sprache, my third language. And every night, can I swear on this?
Yeah. Even in German.
Yeah, because every night, this is what I do. I put the word fuck into words like ausgezeichnet is one of my favorite words. Yeah. It means excellent. Ausgezeichnet. So I say ausgefuckingzeichnet. And I would love to say that. And every night in Madrid, I was jumping on stage and saying, Madrid, buenas fucking noches. And I just love to say that, because my teachers back in my childhood would have gone, now, well done, buenas noches, but you bad swear. Ausgezeichnet, yes. That's TS. You got that pronunciation good. But that's bad, bad, bad. So well done. And bad, so put your hand out. And get, you know, it's like, I love the fact that it's bad but good. And in French, I was saying, absolument. Yeah. I said, should God have come down and flicked Hitler's head off? If there was a merciful God and Hitler and 60 million died, should he, est-ce qu'il doit intervenir? Should he have intervened? Absolument, il doit intervenir. And the kids, when I was playing, I played for 10 weeks in 2011 in Paris, and they were saying, nous disons maintenant absolument. They are saying, the French kids were saying it because it sounded fun.
Well, it's a positive thing. I don't know what the technical linguistic term for it. That there's swearing, which is swearing when you're angry. There's swearing for to give force to something, to say you're enjoying something. And the joy of all those is that you're using another language, and you're not saying I'm finding it hard. You're saying I'm playing. I'm enjoying myself.
Yeah, playing in a way that very polite people would, very posh people would say, now that's not right.
Naughty play.
You must go to hell. It's naughty. You must go to hell forever. But so I do love doing that.
Can we go back to the Market Tavern? Because coincidentally, I was reading Stuart Lee's new book, March of the Lemmings, this weekend, and he mentions the fortnightly billing from the Market Tavern in 1990 was him, Jimmy Miller, Joe Brand, Hattie Hayridge, Mr. Nasty, Simon Munnery, Mark Lamar, Jeff Green, Patrick Marber, and you. That sounds like an absolutely extraordinary place to have been at that time.
Was that the New Material Night?
Yeah.
Yes, that was an amazing thing. And I couldn't ask to join. You had to be asked. And I felt there were two social groups when I was coming up through. And this was my third medium of comedy. So I was doing this weird thing of coming in, having been a sketch comedian, 81, 82, 83 in Edinburgh. Then 85 was street, 86 was street, 87 was street, 88 was street. But I'd started stand-up. And 89 I just did stand up. So by 90, I'd been doing 10 years in three different mediums. And so I was really enjoying it. It was beginning to work and I could see it come. I could see it taken off. And then to get invited to come along to hang out with those guys. And we'd all go for a pizza afterwards in the Pizza Express upstairs. We had this, they knew we were coming. And I just thought, this is the A team. This is these guys were the best of the best in London. And just to be there and do 5 minutes with these people was amazing.
And so, there's lots of kind of stand-up radicals in that list, aren't there? You as well, but and Stu and Munnery and people like that. You go, these are people who actually were just ripping up the form and going, I'm going to try something completely different. Yeah, people going in vague
directions. I think I was very un-radical. At that point, I was just going for funny and surreal. That was my thing. People used to say my stuff was very gentle. And I did realize that I don't think gentle is what I want to be. Yeah. And that's why I started going into, why didn't I take on, from Bill Hicks, I thought, if you take on the right subjects, he was talking about, we're shooting bombs into people's houses and we're doing that. Why don't we shoot bananas into people's mouths? And I just thought, okay, if you choose your right subject. So I started going for human sacrifice and stuff like that and saying, why did we ever go? The weather is bad, the crops have failed, the gods obviously hate us, so we're going to kill Steve. And so you're talking about murder, and then people say, whoa, where's this coming from? And are you complaining? Are you next on the list? Oh, well, good luck, Steve. I'll do the washing up. And so you can play in Human Sacrifice, which is a hellish place. I thought that's a good place for me to be talking about, stuff that's really edgy, war and death and whatever. But how insane that we came up with those things. But the other guys you were mentioning, they were already doing very radical stuff. And no one was telling anyone what to do.
Yeah.
Everyone was just going off. And I'm sure that within that list, not everyone was looking at everyone's stuff and going, oh, this appeals to all of it. Some people were going, I don't know, good luck. I was thinking, good luck to everyone. But I like the surrealist more. I always was Python.
But the also, there's an assumption that whimsy is weak. And surrealism, whereas there's enormous strength in it. Absurdism and taking an idea to the end is... satire can
be that. Death metal whimsy is what you're looking for. It's the word whimsy.
Foot on the monitor whimsy is what you want, the real...
You've got to have the word death in there. It's like... So I do radical moderate. I'm a radical moderate. So
there's power in there. There's strength and there's anger. There can be rage. And I remember being impressed by that for first seeing you do shows and thinking, I can see this is animal whimsy and fun. And then there would be religion and death. Death and murder and God and hard subjects dealt with in a way that was incredibly
hard-ish,
open.
But depending, I think, God. I just used logical analysis on God. I'm a spiritual atheist, so I don't believe in the floaty guy. If he doesn't come in for 60 million dead in World War II, he's not coming, kids. Got a bad leg, your mum's got mumps. He's not coming. He didn't come for 60 million people dead. It killed in the most outrageous way. So if he's not coming down, I think it's politer to say that he doesn't exist than to say he does exist, but he's a bastard. And so that's my just using logical analysis on it. But I did think my earlier God stuff was more playing around with the form.
Might be an idea to put this particular episode of Rule of Three into context, because this is the third part of a trilogy, basically. we did an episode with Mark Haynes and Carrie Quinlan about giving up stand-up. Mm-hmm. And then Joel bumped into Dara O'Brien in Edinburgh, who said, I really enjoyed that. That was a very interesting, different take on stand-up. People who've walked away from doing it. So Joel said, well, listen, why didn't you come on Rule of Three? And Dara said, yeah, I'd love to, because I want to talk about Eddie Izzard's stand-up, because I think he basically reinvented it. Mm-hmm. And I was hugely influenced by him, which has led to you being on here now.
Yeah, well, I listened to that, and I wanted to... Because there were certain questions you guys came up with. Yeah. I haven't been through it and worked out what the questions were.
It was more having a chance to actually talk to you about your process.
Yeah, because there's certain things. This is what I did there, and I didn't do that, and I did do this. Because I've asked questions about Billy Connolly's process. And I've said in interviews, documentaries, and I said, ask Billy, does he write it down? And I don't think he does. I think he does the same thing that I'm doing, which is what a lot of people do, I think. But I haven't actually checked. We don't check with each other how our process is. But some people ask, they write down the words and then they will say the words and then they'll, I assume, muck about with it. Whereas I don't write down any words.
Do you write anything down? Do you make notes for sort of broad topics?
Yes, I do topic. So I'm talking at the moment, I went for a run, my marathons, I was doing 7 marathons in 7 days just to keep that ability doing it. So I just measure them out, and off I go. And I went past this big house, and a dog was woofing as I went past the big gates. And that's happened to us forever. That's happened to everyone forever. There's no comedy in that. But I thought, what if you inject that dog with Fox P2? What would he actually be articulating in his English? What would he be saying? Would he be thief? I think there's a thief. Guys, I'm really pretty sure. I know I'm behind a wall, but that's a thief or a burglar or maybe an assassin. So it got into this dog screaming assassin, which is great. Assassin, assassin. But yeah, dogs jumping up and down and just, because dogs go nuts on it. So yeah. Anyway, so that's what I'll write down. So dog woofing. I've got them. I think I've got, what have I got in the thing, which are things I haven't done, talked about. There's one I talked about, you know, the heads on in Easter Island.
Yes.
Which I've been trying to get into stand-up form, but I can't get it there. It's interesting. Because they built 887, not 888, which you'd think, but 887. So I thought, what was the first? They obviously sat down and said, guys, Easter Island, you know. So Jerry, well done. You said Easter Island. Shirley, you backed them up. So that was voted through in council. And we call it Easter Island. We're hoping people are going to come look for chocolate eggs, but no one's come because we're in the middle of the specific ocean. I know they call it specific. And so what now? Sky blue thinking. Out of the box. Nothing's wrong. Make all dressed up as turkeys. All right. And I never worked this bit out. These should be really stupid ideas. Why don't we all stand on each other's heads? Yes. Okay. Why don't we build a huge head? Okay. Kenneth. Yes, a huge head. You're thinking about 4 foot high. I'm thinking 10 meters high, and it looks like Eagle from the Muppets. Okay. Can we get votes on that? And they get so they got one head, and then how did they get from one to 887? This was my thing. There must have been meetings.
Where one didn't work.
Well, they're going,
two?
Guys, we got 423 enormous fucking heads all over the island. What now? I think another 10, and we'll be there. What? Actually, see, this is more laughs than I've got. I've never managed to get it quite working.
Oh, so stopping at 887. That'll do.
Yes, yeah. No more. But one more, and we're 888.
Well, that's it. It's perfect.
That's the sign of the devil. No, it isn't. That's 222 over the sign of the devil. You're right. Okay, that doesn't mean anything, does it? What? They were in the middle of making their last one when they all blew up and died. Or they all got airlifted off by Martians to live. Anyway, so I do write down.
Do you scribble notes on your phone and, yes. And in things? And do you understand them all? Because mine.
No,
quite often
you go back.
No,
I put them all out. So, I got this thing about Henry VIII. There was this line, you know, never bring a knife to a gunfight. I was trying to do that. This is how it writes. This actually works quite well, and I should actually put it in the show. So I said, I'm talking about Henry VIII in the show, and he ate too much. He suffered from munch too much. And he married too much, and he just went for it. Basically, he was thinking, you know, he ate too much, he married too much. He was thinking, don't bring a knife to a gunfight. That's what he's thinking. Or, you know, don't bring a fork to a knife fight. Or don't bring a spoon to a fork fight. Or don't bring a twig to a spoon fight. Don't bring mud to a twig fight. I was trying to see how far I could go on those. Don't bring a twig to a spoon fight. I quite like that. I don't know if it does work, but it might be too much.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Where do you find when you're doing stuff live and you know the things you're going to talk about, and there are areas, well, I think one of the things that was revolutionary and exciting, and Dara talked about it, was the feeling that you were not making it up as you went along, but you were prepared to let looseness be part of it and to have a chance for things to just catch fire.
Is that within
that's
very
the,
deliberate.
Is that within the sketch parts of it or within
the actual writing? I noticed I was there in the clubs when people would come up with a new thing, the day that they came up with a new idea that caught fire. And you would go, oh, wow, he's got a new bit and a new piece. And they would be on fire with it. And quite often in a set, on a 20-minute set, they might go, ba-ba-da-la-bang, and I said, what are you doing there? Ba-boom, and you'd hear the punchlines, the set of punchlines. And it had become a prayer. It had become almost locked in concrete. Some people were delivering it without joy. They got their 20 minutes. And remember that at the turn of the 90s, that's when we started to change material over much quicker. I claim that I was at the vanguard of that. Because I saw it happen, and there were great stand-ups around me who were doing these set 20 minutes. The idea of mucking about in a show when you've got your 20 minutes, especially at the Comedy Store, don't muck about with it, just keep that stuff, and nothing could move.
Was there a fear of the audience jumping on you if you appear weak?
Yeah, and also the promoters saying, that whole weak section in the middle, I'm not booking you back. Well, they wouldn't say you're not booking, you just couldn't get the whole of them on the phone.
You get notes from promoters in
feedback? No, they would just not necessarily phone you back. If you struggle in the middle of a show, you know, or you went off... Yeah. And Comedy Store late night, you need to be at that late night on a Friday, which was, you know, going up to 3 a.m. when they're just drunk and I'm doing Perez de Cuellar stuff. I was at school with Perez de Cuellar and where I remember Bob Mills told me they're monsters out there, they're crazy, they're wild. This is no night to be going to school with Perez de Cuellar. And all I did was I did my surreal stuff, but very fast, so that I couldn't shout, you fine, you know, in the middle of it, because I wasn't taking any breath. I was doing like circular speed talking. What were we talking just before that?
Having the places to catch fire.
The new material thing, the turn of the 90s, that's when it came in. Because I was improvising in the Screaming Blue Murder Clubs because they had same audience, quite often regular audience were coming. So I thought, I'll try improvising. And it was very difficult. So when you move from doing set stuff to just improvising, that's really difficult. But the more I did it, the more I could get it loose. So my style now is like conversational stand-up. So that if I do stop and go, oh look at the wall, because we've got sound. We've got soundproofing on the wall. Why on some bits of the wall, not other? And I could just go off.
Yeah.
And if I could do that in the room, and it sounded like the rest of the stuff, because the other stuff was kind of conversational as well, / disjointed, then no one could know when I'm coming up with new material. Because that was the thing, that when you were doing set up punchline, set up punchline, set up punchline. Oh, have you noticed how shrimp... when, and they would go into this, oh my God, this is new material.
Tentative.
The confidence, the audience would, their confidence in you would drain out, and your confidence would drain out. And you could feel this going down if they were trying out new stuff.
Wow.
So
you'd make the colours match.
Yeah, they didn't match. So I try to create the whole thing so it all looked like that. So if I'm going off on a tangent, it doesn't actually, it looks like I'm, the whole thing's off on a tangent. And I also noticed that when it was molten, that's when your creativity is, when you're just creating it, it's molten material. So I've tried to make my stuff always molten, because if once you lock it into a prayer, you can't move it after a while. You know, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Mm. People say that as a locked concrete prayer. And if I was a religious person out there, and you're getting people to say that, I would say to them, we're not going to say the Lord's Prayer, but please don't use those words. I'd like you to just look at them and in your head think what you would actually say. Because you really want to say, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be you. I'm praising you. I personally, you know, a person, one is praising you because I think that you're very special. Give us our day. Please, can we have enough food today? That would be great. And I'm sorry if I've done things wrong. But if you said it in your own words, then people will begin to mean it. But lip service in religion has gone on for centuries because people get, this is the form, just say that. And then, amen, whatever that means.
I remember thinking that at school. I remember actually reading it in the Bible. It's a pure Monty Python sketch. And they come to Jesus and say, how shall we pray, O Lord? And he goes, well, something like this. And they go, we'll learn that. And you go, no, he meant something like this. He meant just talk, just chat.
Yes.
And it's quite a sweet little passage if you read it in the Bible. He's just saying, well, just have a chat to him. He's your dad. Just have a little natter. And then everyone learned literally what he said. It's complete life of Brian.
Is that in the...
Yeah, the scene is they come to him and say, how shall we pray, O Lord? He said, a bit like this. And like jazz, like loose. Yet you learn it off by heart.
At one point, he's doing some preaching. And because I think this Jesus guy was a real guy whose name was
Mexican.
Jesus. Yeah. Or no, his real name was Yeshua, because that's the Aramaic.
That's the Aramaic
name.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And for Yeshua to come back, if he is supposed to come back, which I don't think he will because no one does, but if he did come back and he'd say, I'm Yeshua, how's it going? They're going, well, your religion? Nah. There's a guy called Jesus done very well. But that's it.
Well, he'd probably be Josh now, wouldn't he? Surely.
That's Yeshua is now. Jesus is the Greek version of his name.
Yeah.
We're waiting for the return of Josh.
Yeah.
Just a guy coming back from the shops.
Great wise. I think the Yeshua guy was a very wise person who said, hey, guys, live and let live. You know, the birds and the bees, they can do it. Do we have to tear ourselves apart? And he was saying, I think we should adjust Judaism and get it on a better footing and get, you know, get our... He was a hippie, you know. He was kind of that. He was very much a 60s guy in the 30s.
Apple would have signed him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would have definitely been hanging out in the Apple offices.
Yeah, and before. I think he was a good guy. And then he died, and then they kept the religion going. And then this Paul guy, who was Saul, but changed his name to Paul. Yeah. I don't know what the one letter changed. I can never get that. Because he was a Pharisee, and then he got struck by lightning or something, or the donkey exploded, and then he says, oh, I used to be against you Christians, now I'm for you Christians, and I'm living in Turkey. And he came over in a boat and said, I'm living in Turkey, it's going to be Turkey in the future, and I'm with you guys. And he would have had an accent, wouldn't he? From across the seas. I totally with you, all this idea is fantastic. What? Yeah, I love it. This Yeshua guy, I'm kicking ass over here in the, it's got to be Turkey, and I've got this new idea that he's raised from the dead. And he came up with that was Paul, Saul, Joel, that guy came up with the raising for the dead. That wasn't built into the original thing. That's been added on, all the stuff that was added on to
it's non-canon. It's all to do with marketing. It's who you get to do your marketing.
It's also to do with great people coming along and wise thinkers and putting things down. And then the next people, once they're dead, someone says, you know what he was really saying here was murder everyone. And you go, what? if you don't do exactly this, we're going to make... That's a lot of...
Doesn't sound like him.
Yeah, Spanish Inquisition to extreme radical murderous people in Islam that they're just, you know, rewriting what good ideas these wise people have come along with. Wise men and wise women. And most of the wise women have been written out of history.
Let's do this. We're going to try and get from the bedrocks of religion to third rock from the sun. At the moment, the word rock is the only thing that's working.
I'm just going to talk about John Lithgow there's another thing.
Yeah.
Because this is central. They built it for him. They built Third Rock from the Sun for John Lithgow. And when I was seven, I wanted to act. And then I was not... I liked comedy. I didn't know you could specialize in it. Then I thought, as time went on, I wasn't getting any roles, and I discovered Python. I thought, well, let's forget, you know, in puberty, and I just thought, I'm not playing football anymore because I'm at the wrong school that doesn't play it. So I'm not being invited to the party, and I'm not the tall, handsome guy, because I am, you know, if you might think I'm transgender, but I'm a wannabe lesbian. So I was still fancying girls, but it just wasn't working. And so I thought, I'll just do comedy. I won't do drama. But drama was my first love. And but I noticed, I thought, well, can I do drama? Because I, in 1993, I got a separate dramatic agent. So I have a comedy agent and a dramatic agent. So I separated this out and said, I'm only going for dramas. But I worked out that if you get really hit in comedy, because I was trying to hold back, my comedy career was taking off like this rocket. And I was saying, all right, suppress the rocket, slow it down. So it can come down from, you know, Mach 3 to Mach 2, yeah. Mach 1, you know, just get it bubbling up, yeah, simmering up. But then let's get the drama going. And I was going to bring up this second thing, which doesn't really fit together, drama or comedy. And I've noticed that if you really hit in comedy, people are very reluctant to you to go over to drama. But yeah. If you hit in drama first, John Lithgow, and then you do comedy, they say, wow, sense of humor. Gene Hackman in Young Frankenstein. Yep. Wow, he's really funny. And I think that's the only funny thing I've seen Gene Hackman do. But it was really funny when he was
the blind man. Guy.
Yeah. So,
and he does it again in Tenenbaums, and everyone's forgotten he's brilliant.
Yes. Absolutely, you're absolutely right. So that was part of my thinking, and then John Lithgow proved it.
As many intelligent people know, aliens are all around us. This is the story of a band of four such explorers. In order to blend in, they have assumed human form. This is the High Commander. He has assembled an elite team of experts, a decorated military officer, a seasoned intelligence specialist, and, well, they had an extra seat.
I mean, he's hysterically funny. It is weird that they built it for him. I'm not sure what they must have seen him do beforehand. But he is so real in his drama, because the essence of both of them is, because I've compared them both now, and the essence of good drama is to be truthful. The first rule of drama is to be truthful. The first rule of comedy is to be funny. And you can actually be untruthful. You can actually break character. You can pull a funny face and a weird thing. You can do something against character and still get the laughs. But in drama, always be truthful. And you're not allowed to laugh, to get tears, to get anything if you're not locked into that character. But he came from one and did the other and has gone back to the drama. I'm not sure if they're giving him comedies now, but
he's got a theatrical background. He's got the bearing
and a film background.
But he's got the bearing of like a big actor, like a serious, the way that sort of the theatrical knights have over here, the McKellens and the Stewarts and things. And he's got this thing, and they've put him into, he was offered Frasier, I think, originally in Cheers.
Right.
And turned it down. Yeah. He said, I don't want to do a comedy. And then having missed out on it, and probably I imagine having seen Cheers and gone, oh, this is a very, very good blue chip, nice comedy. And
no, I don't think it was. Well, I know.
Wanted to come into.
They tricked him. They said, we're going to build this around you.
They tricked
him into a meeting. You can get it. If you go online and saying, put in John Lithgow tricked in meeting into doing Third Rock from the Sun.
I never wanted to do an episodic sitcom. Bonnie and Terry Turner, this husband and wife comedy writing team who created Third Rock, they had been on the writing staff of Saturday Night Live two of the three times I was a guest host in the 1980s. So they wrote comic review material that I performed, and they saw me as a comic, and they became very good friends. My agent called me one day and said, your friends from New York, Bonnie and Terry Turner, want to have breakfast with you. And I thought, great, I'd love to see them. So I went off thinking this was a social engagement. And there were Bonnie and Terry and Carsey and Werner and Karen Mandebach, all these big shot Hollywood television producers at the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills. And I thought, oh my God, I've been ambushed. This is a pitch.
He is sublime in it. It is amazing. You'd think there'd be a few episodes in it, or there'd be a few certain amounts of inventiveness. And I don't know if it was all scripted. I feel that about half of it or a third of it is coming out of him, and you know, a deal of it is scripted. But they also write to, I know that.
They write to his strengths.
They write to his strengths. But he could just do anything.
Oh, I got you a birthday card.
Happy birthday. You look like $1 million.
Oh.
Old and wrinkled. What kind of a cruel hoax is this?
It's a Hallmark card.
A hallmark of degradation? first line lulled me into a false sense of security, and the second line ripped out my heart and slapped me across the face with it, awakening me to harsh reality.
And the other guys were great in it as well. It's just, I was kind of staggered by, because it's very difficult to watch. I don't think you can download it here.
You can watch it.
We had huge trouble.
Yeah. I think it's on. Someone's put it on Daily Motion. So
yes,
just
Daily Motion.
See it.
That's where. Yeah. That's where.
And it's still visible on there. Which, what's odd is it was a very, very big show and it won loads of Emmys. It won the most Emmys.
And he did. Didn't he win six?
Yeah. He was nominated for six, won three. Kristen Johnston's won a couple for the performances. It's got a reputation as being a very broad sort of mainstream show that's sort of a bit forgotten now. But it was a really big show, really big hit for him, and he is skyscrapingly good in it.
No, please don't.
It went so great. Brad said he liked me. Why won't he call?
There. Maybe he can't call. Maybe his phone is out. Maybe he injured himself running with scissors or used a dry cleaning bag as a toy.
But Lithgow, the thing about Lithgow is so amazing. It's this drama, this ability, and absolutely centered in his drama. Great dramatic work. And a completely insane, surreal comedy. And that is very tricky to pull off. You either get one or the other.
Of course, they got around to saying what they wanted to have breakfast about. They said, Terry, why don't you tell him? He said, well, we're developing this series about these four aliens. And I thought, how am I going to just say no as graciously as I can and get out of here? Within 5 minutes, he'd persuaded me to be in Third Rock and the Sun. Because just exactly what you said, it was an opportunity to surprise people and be far, far more than any one thing, even though it's only one character.
An odd thing to try and describe is that it's a big show. Everyone's allowed to be big and be clowns and do lots of physical stuff. That the two leads are big. I mean, she's a very tall woman and he's a very tall man.
Oh, like the turn statue.
They're literally physically big, which is very funny because what they're playing, if people don't know the setup for Third Rock from the Sun, it's four aliens who have adopted human form to do a research mission. And they've got that lovely fish out of water thing of their aliens on Earth. But the other thing is they're inside their bodies is someone else, like in Big or Freaky Friday. They've got someone else inside them.
Yeah.
And there's something very funny about someone playing that, giving that to a great actor and say, play it that there's someone else inside you. And their bigness becomes really funny. There's like clumsiness. They don't quite fit on the set. And they sort of bump into things. It's very, very funny.
These were aliens who were trying to figure out how to be humans. So they kept trying different approaches and trying to plumb the depths of different human mysteries. Well, that's what we're all doing. And doing it in this hilarious comedy context with this great premise that allowed me, a character actor, to just do everything week by week.
Well, they're big kids, as in like they're behaving like kids, but they're so huge, they're such big figures that it's funny that they're childlike. That there's juxtaposition makes me laugh.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. For it is the great ability to, for me, it's the great ability to have that childlike thing. And one thing that keeps that it's a joke that John Lithgow's character does all the way through and can keep doing it, which is, it's all about me. Me. I want more attention, which is essentially what we all have as kids. And then we're told, it can't all be about you. There's no I in team. Yes, there is. If you could team me, team, we should spell it with two I's. That's how I spell, you know. And everything's all about him.
What's with Harry?
Oh, don't bother him. He's transmitting my status report.
Status report? To the big giant head? Oh, why should we have to answer to that pencil-pushing desk jockey anyway? Frankly, I don't care what he thinks.
What did it say about me?
And his character is put into that situation many, many times. And every time he says, again, I just think this is hysterical.
Well, his role is the high commander, which is like the most sort of, I'm in charge, I'm the boss. And they call him that. And there's a brilliant bit where he gets replaced by an identical version of himself. When he gets sent home for failing the mission, they send another one of him down.
And he's very sexy.
And he's very sexy, but he's very, very high status and very, very sinister. And then the first thing he demands is that...
I may open a box of cereal to get the prize, but I do not then have to eat the cereal.
So even the big, high-status, grown-up version of him is like a little five-year-old. There's no way of taking the little child out of that big man. It's very funny.
Yeah, there's one episode where he's looking at pop-up books, and every time he opens a page, he goes, ah! And then he just calms himself down and goes, ah! And but his screams are better than these screams that I'm doing now. They're just so huge. It's beautiful stuff.
Is that what you liked? Is that the sense of him being able to somehow be a respected stage actor and a very high status man, but also being a pure comedy at the same time?
I'm amazed by that, because that's where I'm driving, and it's very difficult to pull off, because if you imagine the broadcasters, the producers, they want to put someone in who's going to draw a crowd, and they don't quite believe that anyone can draw both crowds. And it is a tricky thing to pull off. You're going to be in a drama and pull a big drama crowd. You're going to be in a comedy and pull a big comedy crowd. They're going to be the same crowd or different crowd. No one knows how that works. And I'm coming to contact with this all the time in doing dramas and films, and then doing very surreal comedy. And, you know, Steve Carell is another one who's done that, and he's moved away from it. Hugh Laurie has moved away from the comedy. Mm. Steve Carell, I think, has moved away from comedy. I'm still doing them both, which is weird.
And that, as the comedy kids say, is the end of part one. So look forward to part two, which should be dropping onto your podcast doormat pretty soon. Hope you enjoy it. See you soon.